What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Cohen and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Rabbi Mary Zamor, author and editor of the new book, The Sacred Table. We'll also have visits from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbert. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Cohen and Too Jewish.
Shalom. At a recent Temple softball game, one of our players hit a little dribbler to short, and while sprinting down the line, shouted, "Hell!" which prompted another player to say, "Careful about your language out there," and, "We don't even believe in hell!" And that led to a whole philosophical debate about Jewish views on life after death, heaven, hell, the soul, on and on throughout the remainder of the ballgame. We lost, unfortunately, or as I put it to our team, we won the silver medal in the game. Anyway, over emails and texts and discussions for the next couple of weeks, the issues stayed fresh. You know, I have played softball for about 30 years now, but this was a first for me. I guess it takes a Jewish temple softball team to spend 5 innings debating whether heaven and hell exist, rather than arguing or even talking about actual baseball. Gotta love Jews in baseball. Anyway, this soft cursing at a softball game reminds me of the only time in my life I've ever been tossed out of a game of any kind. Baseball, basketball, football, softball, tennis, swimming, skiing, running, volleyball, you name it. It happened when I was a rabbi in South Carolina playing in a church league that had a strict no-swearing policy. We had a temple team there too, and it was a very competitive league with lots of good, hard-nosed ballplayers. I was younger then, of course, and better. In fact, the older I get, the better I used to be. Anyway, I was hitting leadoff, playing shortstop. I came up to the plate and swung at a pitch I knew I should have taken and popped it up towards right field. I muttered "damn" under my breath and ran towards first. Then the ball dropped between the fielders, and there I was, standing on first, laughing at my bad swing and good fortune, and the umpire came barreling towards me and threw me out. Frankly, I didn't even think he'd heard me say "damn." So I left. The rule was you had to leave the field completely if you got tossed, and the guys told me later that the umpire was bragging about throwing the rabbi out of the game. I think that was about as close as I ever got to anti-Semitism in South Carolina. Anyway, at our temple softball game, the discussion went kind of the way you would expect it to if you know anything about how contemporary Jews think about life after death. Some of the people on our team thought the Jews don't believe in heaven and hell at all. Some thought that we do. They debated. And eventually they did what Jews sooner or later come around to doing. They asked the rabbi, you know, me. "So, here's the story," I said. "There are strong and varying Jewish beliefs about life after death and heaven and hell, and they go back well over 2,000 years. But there's no real obligation to accept any one of them in order to be a good, practicing Jew. Some of us think the soul is eternal, some still believe in bodily resurrection, and some of us Jews even believe in reincarnation, and some think that nothing exists beyond this life. But all of us, all Jewish tradition really, teaches that whatever happens to us after we die is far less important than what happens to us before we die, when we live. And since that's true, our job is to live as well and as morally as we can, and to work to make this world a better, holier place. Even one softball game at a time."
The ice
When we return in a few moments on Too Jewish, we'll keep making this world a better place. Our guest, my old friend, Rabbi Mary Zamor, will explain how we can make our meals an expression of the Jewish concept of a sacred table, the name of her newish book. Find out how to do that when we come back on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
Hi, Joe Spina, Mama's Pizza. You know, the great Italian philosopher Antonio Garaducci once said, "To find balance in life is to find happiness." Now, I assume he was a smart guy, being a philosopher and all. So it gets me to thinking, balance is probably a good thing when it comes to pizza, too. You know, just the right amount of sauce, cheese, crust, and toppings. But consider this. What one mama's customer might think is just the right amount of something, another customer might think is too much or too little. That's why at Mama's we balance every item we make to each individual customer's taste. Extra cheese or light cheese? Heavy on the sauce or easy on the sauce? Crispy crust or lightly done crust? It's all in balance for each customer. And as Garaducci says, balance equals happiness, and that equals loyal Mama's customers. So I'd say that, on balance, that's a pretty good situation. Mama's Pizza with four convenient locations. Now repeat after me. Mama's Pizza!
Tucson Hebrew Academy is now enrolling students for the fall. THA always knew they had the best kindergarten in town, and now it's official. Following the Outstanding Teacher Award presented by the Jewish Federation of Southern Arizona to THA's kindergarten teacher, Jackie Miller. Kindergarten through eighth grade curriculum centers on rigorous academics, infused with Jewish values and ethics, providing a well-rounded educational experience. While many schools have cut the all-important arts, physical education, and health classes, THA is integrating them into the curriculum in a safe, nurturing environment. We graduate capable, confident students poised for the next chapter in their lives, prepared to enter higher levels of school, and ready to contribute to the larger community. Tucson Hebrew Academy is an award-winning Blue Ribbon school. Last year, THA awarded over $700,000 in financial assistance to students and their families. Great education is more affordable than you think. The best education comes from THA. Space is limited, including in their kindergarten. Call 529-3888 today to register or arrange a private tour. That's 529-3888 or visit THAAZ.org. We are delighted to welcome to Too Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Mary Zamor. She's the editor of The Sacred Table, Creating a Jewish Food Ethic, a wonderful and very interesting new book from the CCAR. She's the associate rabbi of Temple B'nai Or of Morristown, New Jersey. Rabbi Zamor was ordained by Hebrew Union College, Jewish Institute of Religion in New York in 1997. She's considered to have been the first Reform Mashgiach, who oversaw a New Jersey bakery for 4 years. She's a member of Chazon's Jewish Food Educator Network and frequently writes and teaches on a wide variety of topics, including but not limited to kashrut. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning.
I guess I should call you Rabbi. I'm sorry. As you said, I knew you before. So what led to the book, The Sacred Table?
Well, I've been in, as your bio mentioned, I've been involved in the field of kashrut for many, many years. But the actual book came out of experiences I had many years ago, over 9 years ago, with the Central Conference of American Rabbis. I had been invited to sit on a task force to start to define, for internal use, some of our policies. And they brought together a broad cross-section of rabbis who were involved with different food issues to talk about a vision for a policy, a food policy for our own organization. And I was certainly by far the youngest rabbi at that table, so I spent most of my time listening. And as we talked over several face-to-face meetings, it became apparent that there was a lot of excitement about these issues that went beyond a simple food policy, or a rather not-so-simple food policy. And someone along the table suggested maybe a book would be appropriate. And so this was 9 years ago, and I drafted an outline for the book. And while it didn't come to be at that time, I had it in the, well, I guess in the old days it would be in the back of your drawer, but it was in the back of my hard drive, rather, for all these years, and it got transferred from computer to computer as I upgraded. And I kept thinking about this outline, and I thought about all those exciting voices I had heard at the table, each with a unique spin and of a facet of dietary law, kashrut, whatever you want to call it. And so I basically brushed it off recently, over a year ago, and went to the CCR Press, who was very excited to publish it.
It's a very interesting book, and it brings to the reform movement a question that I frankly don't believe the reform movement has ever seriously addressed, the whole question of what it means to eat. What does reform kosher mean? We will talk much more with Rabbi Mary Zamor when we come back in a few moments on Too Jewish.
If your parents or loved ones are in need of advanced assisted living care, then you should know about Handmakers Tynan Neighborhood. It's the only program of its type in Tucson, and is designed for seniors whose needs have exceeded the care available from other assisted living programs. Dorothy Ho is a resident at Handmaker, and she's very pleased with her living arrangements.
My apartment is very comfortable. It's kind of like home now. And everybody here is very pleasant, too.
Dorothy's daughter Gretchen's experience speaks volumes about Handmaker's approach to family and loved ones.
When she first came to Handmaker, I can honestly say that I felt as loved and cared for as my mother has stated recently that she feels she is loved and cared for here.
Handmaker is centrally located on Rosemont, just south of Grand, and includes one and two bedroom suites, cozy studios with patios and balconies, along with a wonderfully caring staff.
I don't even consider them staff, they're friends.
Phone Handmaker today for your tour and consultation, 322-7035, or visit handmaker.org.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website or downloading us from there or from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts.
I'm Spartacus!
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 I'm Spartacus! I'm Spartacus!
It is the 50th anniversary of the film Spartacus, and if you ask its Jewish star and executive producer, Kirk Douglas, what the proudest accomplishment of his 94 years is, the iconic actor cites his action in breaking the infamous Hollywood blacklist with that very movie, Spartacus. Kirk Douglas did it by giving writer Dalton Trumbo full credit for the script of the movie Spartacus. Normally, that's a routine acknowledgement, but in 1960, when the decision was made, openly employing an accused communist or communist sympathizer was a guaranteed career killer, even for one of Hollywood's biggest stars, and it required an extraordinary degree of moral courage. I was always an impulsive guy and young enough not to pay attention to the possible consequences of openly hiring Trumbo, Kirk Douglas, who is now 94 years old, recalls. The San Francisco Jewish Film Festival honored him last week, presenting its Freedom of Expression Award for his courageous actions in support of artistic freedom. Douglas recalls spending plenty of sleepless nights, not in debating his decision, but in cursing the stupidity of it all, in which some of the most talented actors and writers accused of communism couldn't work anymore. Then there was the utter hypocrisy, because everybody in Hollywood knew that Trumbo was writing Spartacus, though under the pseudonym of Sam Jackson. Dalton Trumbo later thanked Douglas, writing, "Thank you for giving me my name back." Kirk Douglas finally had his way. It didn't hurt that he was one of Hollywood's most bankable actors in those days, the Brad Pitt or Tom Cruise of his day. The premiere of Spartacus was followed within 2 months by the opening of Exodus, also written by Dalton Trumbo, and with his name openly listed in the screen credits. The period from the late 1940s to the late 50s is generally known as the McCarthy era, named for the demagogic Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy, and that senator's baleful work was terrible, but it had precedent. It was continued after his death as well by the House Un-American Activities Committee. McCarthy died unlamented in 1957. Among the earliest HUAC targets were the Hollywood Ten, predominantly well-known screenwriters who refused to declare their political affiliations or denounce colleagues. They were cited for contempt of Congress and imprisoned for up to a year. While Dalton Trumbo was not Jewish, six of the other Hollywood Ten were Jewish, and among many politicians and compilers of suspect lists, charges of being a New York or Hollywood commie simp served as a code for being Jewish. Along with Kirk Douglas, Spartacus also featured two other prominent Jews, director Stanley Kubrick, author Howard Fast, also blacklisted, who wrote the original book. It was based on the life and death of the Thracian slave whose followers nearly overthrew the mighty Roman Republic in the first century BCE. So, was the campaign against politically unreliable artists fueled by anti-Semitism? Kirk Douglas thinks so. "Listen, all my life I've always assumed everybody I met was an anti-Semite unless he could prove otherwise," he said. Douglas found in the Spartacus Revolt an analogy to the current uprisings in the Arab Middle East. "If Spartacus were to return today, he would go to Libya or Syria to fight with the rebels," says the actor, who in 1996 won an honorary Academy Award for 50 years as a creative and moral force in the motion picture community. Kirk Douglas' real name is Isser Danielovich. He learned early about anti-Semitism in boyhood fights in Amsterdam, New York, but he made his way in Hollywood as a Nordic-looking leading man with that cleft chin, and as he did, he shed most of his religious upbringing, which was Orthodox. "However," he said, "I always fasted on Yom Kippur. I still worked on the movie set, but I fasted. And let me tell you, it's not easy to make love to Lana Turner on an empty stomach." I'll have to take his word for that. Later in life, after surviving a terrible helicopter crash, Kirk Douglas returned to Jewish practice. "I came to believe that I was spared because I had not yet come to terms with my Judaism. I had never come to grips with what it means to be a Jew," he said. In his mid-70s, Douglas embarked on an intensive regimen of Jewish studies. He discovered the greatest screenplay ever written. It has passion, incest, murder, adultery, really everything. "That's why they keep making movies about it." He means, of course, the Hebrew Bible. Kirk Douglas had a second bar mitzvah at the age of 83. He still studies regularly with Rabbi David Wolpe of Sinai Temple in his own Beverly Hills home, and he has become both a well-regarded author and an important philanthropist. Kirk Douglas has given literally hundreds of new playgrounds to impoverished kids in California and in both Arab and Jewish neighborhoods in Israel. Quite a story. Kirk Douglas, who is now 94 years old and has written 9 books, promises his last book will be called It's Hard to Be a Jew. All this on the 50th anniversary of I Am Spartacus. We welcome our maven on Israel, Guy Gelbart, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Good morning, Guy. Boker Tov.
Boker Tov, Rabbi.
We've been talking about the Israel Defense Forces and kind of exploring the whole cultural aspect of being part of the army. We started talking a little bit about prime ministers and their role. It seems like many of the prime ministers of Israel have actually put themselves on the line physically in danger for the state, served in frontline units, been in all kinds of action. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Yes, it does seem that many of Israel prime ministers and political leaders have a military past in serving in the IDF. In some ways, when someone goes to a very frontline unit and serves for many years there, it tells you a lot about their character. First of all, it tells you that they are willing to do a lot for the country, to give a lot, to sacrifice, to take risk. It also tells a lot about their managerial skills, because someone that was chief executive of the IDF or a main commander, in a way, was managing part of the biggest system in Israel. Israel does have industry and big factories, but neither one of them is as complex, as challenging as a big military unit. Commanding on a big military unit, it's not only a matter of courage, and of being able to sacrifice or do for your country. It also means that you know how to manage your logistics, your people, to plan ahead, to make tough decisions under stressing conditions in very short time, sometimes with low resources. It's all the things that you are expecting from a good manager. And when you want to choose your prime minister, you want a good manager.
It may not be all you want, but it certainly is a big part of it. You know, I was thinking back on the prime ministers of Israel. Netanyahu obviously had frontline service. Sharon commanded the Southern Command and was something of a military hero. Rabin commanded the IDF. Barak commanded the IDF. You know, a lot of high-level people. I was saying, well, you know, Golda Meir didn't, but that you brought up something really interesting.
Well, Golda was involved with, let's say, some secret operations.
Clandestine negotiations.
Partly, she went to visit King Hussein on a secret mission. They're very interesting stories. I don't know how many of them are told yet. but she was. She was involved. And also, Tzipi Livni was very deeply involved with some secret operations that some of them I don't even know. And many people don't know, but she was there.
Very interesting. I remember, in addition to them, I remember Barak dressing in a dress at one point in Lebanon. Yeah. And being part
Aviv
of the Marine.
Yeah. Operation.
A big secret operation that's not a secret anymore.
Yeah. Well, they wrote a book about it, so it's not very secret. It was Operation Aviv Neurim, a very famous one. You can Google it.
Thanks, Guy. We'll talk next week.
Okay, thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
We visit weekly with the outstanding restaurateur, Janos Wadler of Janos Restaurant at the J-Bar. Good morning, Janos.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Janos is the finest restaurant in the Southwest. J-Bar, the most fun in all of the Southwest, I'd say, but they're also great places to hear music in the summer.
I think that's one of the things that makes J-Bar and Janos so fun in the summer is the summer music series. We have music every Wednesday and Thursday night out under the stars. And it's a really busy time, a really fun time for us, and great musicians, local musicians, but local musicians who also tour all around the world, and we get them at J-Bar.
You can sit outside, look at the stars, eat great food, have a drink, and just enjoy the summer with the summer music series at Janos and the J-Bar.
And I'll see you there, Rabbi. Give us a call, 615-6100, and we'll have your table ready for you out under the stars listening to the music.
And eating and drinking. What's the website?
www.janos.com. The full summer music schedule is on the web.
JNOS.com. Thanks, Janos.
Thank you, Rabbi.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Well, we had a wonderful dinner on top of your hotel in Rome a few weeks ago when Wendy and I were on the tail end of a cruise, had gone to services at the Great Synagogue in Rome. And we didn't actually go in the museum. It wasn't open on Shabbat, but you did and found a great exhibit there on the Jews of Libya.
Right. So on the Sunday, I was showing around 4 18-year-old kids who had just finished high school, and very bright, very interested in Jewish things, whatever. And under the Great Synagogue, which was built obviously after Rome became part of the Secular Republic of Italy, there is a fantastic Jewish museum, which I visited many times, and it's quite extensive. And often the only way that you can visit the synagogue is to visit the museum and then go with a guide from the museum upstairs into the synagogue. And that was the case on this day because there were things going on in the synagogue. People, for their like golden wedding anniversary, have a rededication there and they fill the synagogue. I mean, huge numbers of people come for things like this. And it turns out, unbeknownst to me, that Rome actually has 10 functioning synagogues.
Right.
So it's a thriving Jewish community with a whole range of community services. And one way we can support those services is by paying the admission fee to the museum and patronizing the museum gift shop and stuff like that. Anyway, there was a temporary exhibit on the Jewish community in Libya, about which most people, I dare say, know next to nothing. And the Jews of Libya who didn't go to Israel and stayed on after 48 went in large numbers to Italy because of the close relation. I mean, Italy at one point had colonized
North Africa and Libya.
One of the things we learned about the history of the Libyan community is it's as old as the communities in Thessaloniki, which we touched on last week, and the community of Rome, which far predate the Christian era.
It goes back to the time of the Maccabean revolt against the Greeks.
Right. So it's well into the BC era.
Yeah, 2nd century BC.
And it was extremely interesting for both for me and the kids to learn something about a community which really no longer exists except in exile, both in Italy and in Israel, but had clearly a very long and very rich history, culturally, artistically, et cetera, et cetera.
Well over 2,000 years. You know, fascinating communities, and they're all a little different with different music, different foods, slightly different rituals.
Right.
It's extraordinary. And that part of North Africa, Cyrene and Roman times, right. A very big Jewish area.
Yeah. And the guide to the museum pointed out that when Jews were expelled from Spain, was one of the major waves of immigration to Rome, but there were many Jews there long before,
oh,
or whatever,
yeah.
And that each congregation had its own traditions and its own nusach and whatever, etc. So I remembered the one time that I went to the synagogue in Thessaloniki, nusach Thessaloniki sounds like the Armenian Orthodox Church. It sounds very Eastern and very ancient. And not at all like, you know, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, what we consider Sephardic, because,
right.
In fact, it's not Sephardic.
No,
it's pre-Sephardic.
Not. That's right. So. We will talk on this and other fascinating subjects next week. Thanks, Tom.
Looking forward to it.
And now it's time for the old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. Shlomo and Rivka just got married. They're on their honeymoon. That night, as he's making love to Rivka for the first time, Shlomo looks down and says, "Am I the first man to make love to you, Rivka?" Rivka looks up at him and replies, "No, Shlomo, I'm sure I would have recognized you." That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now, a word of Torah. This week we begin reading Dvarim, Deuteronomy, the final book of the Torah. The name Deuteronomy captures a midrashic explanation of the essence of this final sefer. It means a repeated text, Hebrew, a Mishnah Torah. Reflects the fact that the whole book of Dvarim is a few long sermons by Moses, recapitulating the events and commandments established over the previous three books, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers. Not bad speechifying for a guy with a major speech impediment. Anyway, a word about language in Dvarim, which seems appropriate, since the word Dvarim means literally words. The Hebrew of this book is extraordinary, terse, strong, muscular in quality, carrying a sense of great purpose and power. It has the unmistakable feel of a true literary masterpiece. And the language itself conveys Moses' message of God's explicit direction as clearly as any text in the Torah. Sometimes the medium is the message, and it proves to be so here in Dvarim. This narrative of Deuteronomy begins at the end of the Israelites' journey to the borders of Canaan, the promised land, soon to be renamed Israel. Moses informs the people of Israel that he has now led them for 40 years, and that they have now come to a place and time of the greatest importance. One of the first incidents he recalls goes back to the days when the Israelites were beginning to get organized, and Moses himself had just appointed judges and magistrates to help him with the needs of the people. Moses remembers the instructions he gave those leaders, be fair and absolutely even-handed in dispensing justice. Do not favor the rich. Do not favor the poor. Show no partiality. Simply seek that which is just and right in the world. This is, of course, just the beginning of Moses' long orations, his last hurrah, so to speak. Although he is now, by biblical calculation, 120 years old, though his control over his people has waned, even though his speech is tinged with the bitter knowledge that he will not get to enter the promised land, still he teaches us yet again the greatest lesson. For we Jews must be pledged to create in this uncertain and even unjust world acts and systems of ethics and justice. And what greater calling could any people have? When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll learn about the ethical Jewish component in food and how what we eat makes us holy. Find out how when we return on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174. We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In the Middle East, the so-called Arab winter and Arab spring have now given ways to the Arab dog days of summer. And as the world stands idly by, Syria's government and army under Bashar Assad continue to kill their own citizens brutally. But the Syrian citizens' protests grow only larger in the face of this repression and more widespread. Last week, Syrian troops opened fire on scores of people in a Damascus suburb, killing at least 8, some people say 11, who were trying to halt the soldiers' advance by throwing stones and burning tires. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says the residents of the Kanaker suburb were trying to set up blockades around the area to stop tanks and a bulldozer that were trying to get in. The army raid also wounded a number of people who were treated in mosques that residents turned into makeshift hospitals. The raid occurred after electricity and telephones were cut off in the area by the military. The Syrian government has banned foreign media and restricted coverage, making it hard to independently confirm the eyewitness accounts. The violence was the latest turn in the Syrian uprising against President Bashar Assad. It has lasted for nearly 5 months, despite a brutal government crackdown on dissent. The Syrian army has killed at least 1,600 people in those months, most of them unarmed protesters. Although Assad's regime blames the unrest on terrorists and foreign extremists, Assad has acknowledged the need for reform. The ruling Ba'ath Party, which calls for unity, freedom, and socialism, has held a monopoly over political life in Syria for decades. But in the face of continued growing uprising, last week Assad's own cabinet endorsed draft legislation to enable newly formed political parties to run for parliament and local councils. But the promises are not going to appease protesters. Assad, who inherited power in 2000 after the death of his father, the brutal President Hafez al-Assad, has made a series of overtures, but the protests have only grown larger. Although the uprising began in mid-March with calls for reform, the steadily climbing death toll, 1,600 people, the evidence of mass murder and torture of children by the Syrian army and secret police, and the slow pace of reform has enraged protesters. Many of them now say they won't accept anything short of Assad's ouster, which would be a really good idea, and a shift away from brutal autocracy towards perhaps some concept of democracy in Syria. Did you know that over the entire course of the last intifada, about 1,000 Palestinians died and a fair number of Israelis? 1,600 Syrians have died in the last 5 months, with virtually no international protest.
They tried to make me go to rehab. I said no, no, no. Yes, I've been black, but when I come back, no, no, no. I ain't got the time, and if my daddy thinks I'm fine, they tried to make me go to rehab. I won't go, go, go.
Amy Winehouse, the talented and troubled singer who exploded onto the worldwide music scene with her 2006 Grammy-winning album Back to Black, is dead. The Beehive's soul jazz diva, whose self-destructive habits overshadowed a distinctive musical talent, was 27 years old. Winehouse shot to fame in 2006 with Back to Black, whose blend of jazz, soul, rock, and classic pop was a global hit. It won 5 Grammys and made Winehouse, with her black hairdo, old-fashioned sailor tattoos, and unique persona, one of music's most recognizable stars. But her personal life, with its drug and alcohol abuse, eating disorders, and physically and emotionally destructive relationships, soon took over. Winehouse was found dead at her home in Camden Square in northern London. Her death comes a month after she canceled a series of gigs following an incoherent performance in Belgrade. The pop star publicly struggled with alcohol and drug problems throughout her career. Her biggest hit was the song Rehab. Given those struggles, her death is not necessarily a surprise, but it is terribly sad. It brings to a tragic conclusion what could and should have been a great musical career. Last month, Winehouse completely canceled her European comeback tour after she had swayed and slurred her way through barely recognizable songs in her show in the Serbian capital of Belgrade. Booed and jeered off stage, she flew home. And management said what it always said, she would take time off to recover. She was last publicly seen at a London concert last week when she joined her goddaughter, Dionne Broomfield, on stage. In that impromptu appearance, Winehouse danced with her and encouraged the audience to buy her album. Her biggest album, Back to Black, took 4 years to write and record. It was released in the U.S. in 2007 and went globally huge. "I didn't go out looking to be famous," Winehouse said. "I'm just a musician." In the end, the music was overshadowed by the fame and by her demons. Tabloids lapped up her erratic stage appearances, drunken fights, stints in hospitals and rehab clinics. Performances became shambling, stumbling train wrecks watched around the world on the internet. Born in 1983 to Mitch Winehouse, a taxi driver, and his pharmacist wife Janice, Winehouse grew up in the North London suburbs. Went on a showbiz career from an early age. When she was 10, she and a friend formed a rap group, Sweet and Sour. Winehouse was sour. No surprise. She later described it as the little white Jewish salt and pepper. Winehouse was supremely talented, but always looked like she would end up, well, disastrously. Sadly, that's come true. And of course, her biggest hit was Rehab. The man said, "Why do you think you do it?" I said, "I got no idea. I'm gonna lose my baby." So I always keep a bottle on it. May Amy Winehouse rest in the peace that eluded her in life. And one more little story. While many police officers watch smuggling into Israel, the biggest bust they have had this year was 50,000 fake pills coming in from China. And what were they smuggling? Fake Viagra. That must not only be illegal, but perhaps even a sin. You know, I just couldn't leave with that down story. We had to give you something up. And that's the news of Jews around the world. We're delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi Mary Zamor. She's the editor of The Sacred Table, Creating a Jewish Food Ethic, a book that addresses the whole question of what it means to have us, you know, make your food matter in a moral, religious, Jewish sense. I want to share something with you and get your reaction. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that in the reform movement, there is a not only a broad array of choices that people make about being kosher, there's a broad array of choices that synagogues make about how they're going to even respond to the question of, you know, should this be kosher? What should we or should we not eat? Where should we get our food? What's the ethic of it? And mostly it's been defined in a negative sense. We're not kosher, we're reform. How would you respond to that? And how would you describe where the reform movement is going now?
That's a wonderful question. I agree that for many Jews, whether they're reform or not reform, in some ways the definition of being reform is not keeping kosher. And it's interesting because in the sacred table there that we open with a whole part of the book, which is a historical overview and perspectives on this, and it's interesting to see the overall historical development of Reform Judaism and its interaction with Kashrut. And you'll see through those articles that that is both true and not true. It is much simpler to create your own individual food ethic. And I like to call that kashrut, meaning that kashrut is our Jewish relationship with our food. So it's ritual, it's environmental, it's a concern for workers' rights, animal rights, spirituality, and not only feeding ourselves, but making sure that others are fed through our work of tzedakah and tzedek, of charity work, both through money and through the work of our hands. And so as we interact with one another, it gets more complicated. So on the congregational level, it's important that congregations take the time to educate themselves, to create broad, rich discussions. And in the Sacred Table, we provide resources. And also on the CCR Press website, there are online resources developed by Rabbi Jeff Brown, which allow people to see the broader context and to make educated choices together. But it's important to remember that our congregations are in some ways just as complicated as our homes, that any time we interact with our nuclear families, our partners, our broader families, our friends, these are just complex, and that that we need to be in discussion with one another as we decide how we're going to make our kitchens, where we're going to do our shopping, what restaurant we're going to pick.
Have you received any, I don't know, I'll say hostility, but negative response? After all, the reform movement often dates itself as being a unique movement from the Treif banquet. You know, have you heard any of that? Why are you bothering with this?
Overall, no. I would say the overall reaction to the book has been a great deal of excitement, both from the Reform community and beyond the Reform community, that everybody sees a little bit of themselves in the discussion that's created through the book, and that's a very positive thing. I have online and in person heard a few darker comments, but most of them, when you sit and talk with people and debunk them of the myths and stereotypes that they've been holding, I think that they can see the broader vision of the book and what we're trying to achieve. Within the Reform community, I'm very careful to talk about educated choice. This book is not about literally shoving food down people's throats. It's about educating them to make wonderful religious choices.
Nigel Savage founded Chazon, who wrote the preface for your book, a former guest of Too Jewish, I might add, has made wonderful linkages about the ethics of the ways that we eat food, how the food is raised, what it does to the world and to the environment. Is that, you know, this is kind of, and this has had great traction in the conservative movement as well, the concept of ethical kashrut. Is that, do you think, the most important direction for the reform movement? Is there one more important direction than another?
I don't think there is one direction that's more important than the other. I think that given the profile of Reform Judaism in our history and wonderful interaction with ethical issues, with the prophetic vision, that's for many of us, an easier place to go. It's easier for us to talk about the ethical imperatives, talking about workers' rights, animal rights, environmental rights, and that's a good thing. We should be talking about this. They're very, very important issues. But I think it's important to see the connection between ritual kashrut and ethical kashrut. And that's why I like to call all of it just kashrut. I don't like to separate out into ethical kashrut, eco-kashrut, ritual kashrut. These factors all interplay beautifully together. When you sit at a meal and you say a blessing before you eat, it creates a mindfulness. And that is ritual. But hopefully that ritual also heightens your awareness and should heighten your awareness of making you think for a second, what's on my plate? Where did it come from? What kind of plate is it sitting on? Is it a disposable plate? Is it a reusable plate? That all of these issues should strengthen one another.
It's a beautiful integration and an awareness of living. That's really sort of what I think all of us rabbis try to create for our congregants. Rabbi Eric Yaffe at the National Biennial for the Reform Movement in Toronto a year and a half ago or so dedicated a great deal of his message to really consciousness of food and our footprint on the planet, and spoke about not eating meat so much, which, you know, went over extremely well. A group of rabbis went out and founded Rabbis for Ribeyes. Is this a serious, I struggle a little bit, because while it seems extremely important and beautiful, doesn't it lend itself to some parody?
I think anything lends itself to parody. And while it's good to laugh at ourselves, I think it's important to look at the deeper issues. You know, Rabbi Yaffe picked a very controversial thing to say. As he has over the years, he's said many controversial things. But certainly, whether it's Michael Pollan or Mark Bittman, Alice Waters, there are plenty of heavy-hitting secular thinkers who've gone out on that same limb very successfully to ask people to think about the impact of eating so much meat. You know, to ask people to be conscious of the impact of meat production on our bodies and the environment is an important thing.
There are many Reform congregations now who have begun to adopt some kind of policy about food. Do you think that there could be a general statement that they might look to adopt, and maybe conservative congregations as well? Is that something you would encourage, or do you think people just need to find their own way?
I think it's a cross-section. I think the more that we see what everyone's doing in their little microcosm, it helps give us templates and models and role models for these discussions, but ultimately those discussions have to be had on the very local level. Again, through Jeff Brown, Rabbi Jeff Brown's work, in the book, we have many resources for people to draw upon, including some templates from other communities. But it's important that when people have these discussions that it's not just about ritual. They may be saying, well, we're not going to serve pork products, we're not going to serve shellfish, but they should also be thinking about what's being done with the leftovers. What about the encouragement of reusable plates? A lot of congregations invest in a set and then rent them out for different joyous occasions so that people have access to, you know, a full set of catering plates and they don't have to use disposable. That these things, these broader values have to be part of that discussion.
I introduced something called stealth kashrut in my congregation.
Mm-hmm.
Because while there was a policy, you weren't supposed to have pork and shellfish, we would serve chicken, but it was rotisserie chicken from the corner market. And we gradually moved over under the influence of actually assistant rabbis and other people as well to only serving kosher meat. The only meal at my congregation that isn't, it may not be as kosher as some people would say, but that doesn't have kosher meat and isn't separated dairy and milk, the only meals that we eat there that are not in that category are the board dinners, which the board caters and brings in. We're probably not alone in that. Is there a possibility of creating something that people might be comfortable with that doesn't end up with those kinds of dichotomies? What's the process that would maybe lead to that?
Well, I think an open discussion, and a colleague recently said to me, not about his kashrut policy at a synagogue, but about trying to instill the congregation with greater environmental values in general, but it had an impact on food, that they were switching over to only reusable plates and glasses at their oneg, so that during social hour they would have nothing disposable. And the way he sold it to his board was, rather than making an institutional policy, he said, let's try it for 2 months. Let's track how much this is costing us in terms of electricity, in terms of labor, in terms of water usage for washing all this stuff. And let's compare that to what we were spending on disposables, because the congregation was giving him the directive that whatever he does cannot cost them more money.
Right. It has to be revenue neutral.
It has to be in this day and age, and that's unfortunate. But rather than saying, let's make a policy, he was saying, let's try it and see how it works. And I thought for this situation, it was a wonderful response. It was one about conversation, about process, and being able to look at the spreadsheet together and say, well, what do you think?
I want to thank Rabbi Mary Zamor for a great visit. Her book is called The Sacred Table, Creating a Jewish Food Ethic. You can find it at ccrnet.org, the Central Conference of American Rabbis website. And I expect you can find it all over the web now.
On Amazon.
The best place. And by the way, somebody at Amazon listens to Too Jewish because they took an author and told her all about us not too long ago. Thanks, Mary. We encourage you to go find the book.
Thank you, Sam. It's been a pleasure.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest, get a final musical play out.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Next week, our guest will be Joan Ligant, the fine author of Wherever You Go and An Hour in Paradise. Our play out this morning comes from Neshama Karlbach. It's called Hu Elokeinu, You Are Our God. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.